I'd like to welcome everyone again to the second night of our series, and I'm very thankful for your desire to be here to hear a lesson on one of the most important subjects that I see in facing Christianity today. Last night I talked about why it was so important, understanding that Christianity is under attack, and they're attacking the very foundations of our faith, that is the fact that God is our creator. Psalm 11 and verse 3 says, if the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? Well, if we stand by idly and watch the foundations of our faith be destroyed, we're going to lose a lot of righteousness. We're going to lose a lot of people people's faith because we fail to explain to them the truth. And as our foundation crumbles, we begin seeing the moral fabric of our society crumble around it. And tonight I hope to help you understand what it is evolution really is. Evolution, of course, claims to be a fact. It claims to be scientific. And tonight I hope to show you how their claims are false, as well as giving you some understanding of how to keep yourself from being indoctrinated, things to look out for, and things that you can do to assure that you won't become a part of the problem, or rather be a part of the solution to the world in which we live in. To begin with, I want us to look at what evolution says that it is, what it claims that it is. Trying to define evolution in a single sentence is pretty much impossible because it depends on what field of science you're talking about. Just about every field of science deals with evolution, and they'll have an evolution of their particular branch, and it's defined based upon their branch of evolution. For the purpose of tonight's lesson, I want to focus in on three different types of evolution. Be the ones that most of our understandings of evolution doctrine stem from. That being cosmic evolution, chemical evolution, and what we call neo-Darwinian evolution. Regardless of what type that you're dealing with, all of them essentially try to ask the same question. Why are we here? I guess that great philosophical question man has always seemed to be asking. Why are we here? The Bible, of course, has an answer to that, and I plan on sharing that with you at the end of the lesson. But when science begins to answer that question, depending on their field of science, they're going to tell you different things. When looking into the cosmic evolution, when they try to answer the question, why am I here? They're going to explain to us that we're here because a big explosion happened. That's typically the way they say it. I suppose there are several other theories out there about the universe and how it all began. Some of them even stating that it didn't begin at all, that it's always been. I suppose if you're a big reader into physics and such, you would understand who Stephen Hawking is. And knowing that he teaches there was no evolution to the origin of the universe. There just always was. The reason why they're saying such things is because if they proclaim that there was a beginning, there has to be a cause. And that's the big thing that cosmic evolution has difficulties with. I can remember in my science classes, and I realize that my grade school and high school science teachers are hardly doctorates. When asking them questions about why it is that why this big explosion, this big bang that they talk about happened, they would often reply with, well, a big explosion happened before that. Well, that seems a bit circular reasoning, doesn't it? You mean to tell me a big explosion caused all the matter in the world to spread out to where it is today, and the explosion that caused that, and there was an explosion before that that caused all the matter to go in a single spot. And they said, yes. And we call this science. So according to the April 2002 edition of Discover magazine, it stated that, according to the Big Bang Theory, that a ball of mass no bigger than a marble about 10 to 15 billion years ago exploded. I want to know which one of them witnessed it. I would like to know how it is they knew exactly how big it was. Incidentally, that ball of mass has gotten smaller and smaller over the last 20 years. And the time frame the Big Bang took place has gotten longer and longer, older and older. And of course, what we can see is it not actually taking place. And we'll look a little bit at that a little bit later in today's lesson. Of course, then we have chemical evolution. We're trying to answer the question, why are we here? Chemical evolution says that we are here because life just sprung up from nowhere, or from somewhere, or from somewhere else, depending on who you're talking to. Three main theories are proposed to how life started in the first place that are generally accepted in the scientific world. One most of us are probably familiar with is a primordial soup that existed somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 billion to 4.5 billion years ago. This is what the Miller-Urey experiment, that icon of evolution I mentioned last night and we'll spend a great deal of time talking about tomorrow, is associated with. There's, an explanation of how life came forth from non-life. Some of them will tell you, well, that's impossible to believe that life sprang forth from non-life in some soup 4.5 billion years ago is ridiculous. A man by the name of A.G. Carnes-Smith said in 1966 it was so ridiculous that there had to be another answer. And his response was it came off the back of crystals. I began looking over his website to understand a little bit more about what he meant by that, and that's about as vague as he wants. And it was also about as specific as he wants. Well, what do you mean by the backs of crystals? The more I looked over, well, it couldn't be this, and it couldn't be that, so the only logical explanation was it come off the back of crystals. And as crystals mutate, one of the mutations happened to be life itself. Now, as staggering as that seems, there's actually professors at the University of Florida that teach it. Florida State that teach it. Let me get my schools in Florida correct. And then some will tell you, well, believe it come off of crystals is ridiculous. Trying to prove that it spawned from some soup 4.5 billion years ago is impossible, so maybe life began somewhere else. As far-fetched as it may seem, it was actually discussed in a biology textbook used here at Thomas Dale, that life began in outer space. Richard Dawkins, a leading philosophical Darwinist, stated that he would rather accept life beginning in outer space before he accepted God as the answer for life. When we begin to view it for what it really is, you can begin to see the ridiculous nature that they're expecting people to believe. If we just ask an honest question, how did it happen, they don't have an answer. And of course, all this began with Darwin. With Darwinian evolution, which is today classified as neo-Darwinian evolution. The origin of the species. That's what it tries to answer. How did we get here? How is it that that single-celled organism that was first created 4.5 billion years ago turned into what you look in the mirror every day? Darwin said it was the survival of the fittest, or natural selection. This catchphrase isn't the answer that it used to be. That's why we call it neo-Darwinianism today. They believe it's a lot more complicated than just simply survival of the fittest. They believe that genetic mutations are necessary on the cellular level in order for evolution to take place. And they believe that these genetic mutations enable the mutants to survive better. And as a result, their new genetic material, the new genetic traits, are passed on to the next generation. And that generation survives better than the others around it, and it passes it on down to the next generation. Of course, in these genetic mutations, it needs to be understood that for evolution to work, according to neo-Darwinianism, it has to be an addition to genetic material. That is, that you grew something that you didn't previously have. To use humankind, someone was born with wings. See, we can have people born with six fingers or six toes. It happens. That's a genetic mutation. But it's not an addition of genetic mutation. Because you already have the programming inside of your DNA to grow fingers and toes. And to have a sixth one doesn't mean that you had an addition to genetic mutation. It also doesn't mean that your children will have six toes. But to grow wings, well, there is no DNA strand, no code inside the human DNA that says that a human can have wings. And that is necessary for neo-Darwinian evolution to take place. And we're going to talk more about this tonight and again tomorrow. Of course, it always is always, it claims to be a fact. I said that several times last night. That is what they claim. Out of Richard Milner's Encyclopedia of Evolution, this is what he has to say about evolution. This, I believe, was written in the creationism section of his book. He says, evolution became as fact, became established as fact, not because it won debates among the armchair philosophers or logicians, but because it unified thousands of disparate observations by comparative anatomists, field naturalists, geologists, paleontologists, botanists, and later geneticists and biochemists. See, it's a fact because everybody says it's a fact. That's what he said. Based upon their observations, they said it could be no other answer. There's a serious flaw with that. Because based upon their observations that are slanted to their already materialistic and naturalistic worldview. If you teach somebody their entire life that they evolved from a single-celled organism, and you never show them an alternative, guess what they're going to see in the world around them? They evolved from a single-celled organism. But if you teach somebody that we were created, they're going to see something entirely different. Now, if you read in a science textbook, they're not going to give you Richard Miller's explanation as to why it's a fact. They will try to compare it to the theory of gravity. Saw that done in one textbook. Well, theory of evolution is a lot like the theory of gravity. Gravity is a fact. If you jump, you will land. If you fall off of a tree, fall out of a tree, you're going to hit the ground. You drop something heavy on your foot and it's going to hurt because of gravity. No one denies it. What they don't understand about gravity is how it all works, which is why it's called a theory. And then they will say evolution is much the same. Evolution is a fact because we have all the evidences for it. And we're going to tear down these evidences tomorrow when we look at the icons. I'm going to tear them down as best that I can. What we don't understand, they say, about evolution is how it all happened. How life sprang forth from nothing, how the universe began in the first place, and how it is that mutations occurred and brought rise to eventually, as I said earlier, what we see in the mirror. This is what they claim that evolution is. The truth of the matter is, evolution is not a fact. Facts are truths, hard evidence, and undeniable observations. That's how you know something is a fact. There's no way to deny it. And the fact that people deny evolution ought to tell you it's not deniable. It's not undeniable. But evolution cannot be a fact, number one, because it cannot be observed today. Now, they'll tell you that it's observed today. I'm going to tell you they see it in their four-winged fruit flies. See, evolution happened because a wing grew four wings. A fly grew four wings. They say, see, that's evolution at work. And they're going to show you pictures of pepper-colored moss. And they say, see, that's evolution at work. That's not. Evolution as we define it, that is the addition of genetic material, that is life springing forth from nothing and the Big Bang taking place, those things are not witnessed today. No one has ever seen the Big Bang happen. No one's ever seen it happen since. And I'm certain if you spend any time reading on the internet, perhaps in your newspapers or listening to television, you've heard over the last couple of months I wish I could remember which one of these countries it was in Europe. I forgot which one that it was in. Was creating this large atom smasher. It's one of the Scandinavian countries. I just can't remember which one. And there was a man who was terrified that if they ran this thing, they would recreate the Big Bang and would form a black hole in the center of the earth and swallow us all up. That's what happens when you start believing in the Big Bang theory. Nobody knows what's going to happen. No one knows how the Big Bang happened or what it looked like. Yet they were certain that by watching atoms smash together hundreds of times, they'd figure it out.
The only way they could know that that simulates the Big Bang Theory is if somebody was there 10 to 15 billion years ago watching it. Because that's what science is. According to Sir Francis Bacon, the creator of the scientific thought, you observe what you see, what you smell, what you taste, what you can weigh. Things in the present. The problem with science today is we have a lot of what's called historical science. It is trying to figure out what happened millions of years ago and billions of years ago. But no one's observed the Big Bang. And no one has observed chemical evolution. No one's figured out how life was began in this world because no one's ever seen it happen. There's not been a single occasion in some laboratory someone was watching a bunch of water that had nothing but amino acids in it, and then, bam, a cell formed. And despite all the work that SETI has done, no alien life forms has appeared yet. And all the people that study rocks, these geologists, they haven't seen life spring up on the back of one of those yet either. It's not been witnessed. And over the last couple of months, I know the television stations in our area was running it, that they've got this man who claims that he's about to create life. And he's got his amino acids and his proteins and his fatty acids, and they're all circling one another. Says, I'm so close to creating life. No, he's not. The big reason for that is because he programmed it. We'll talk more about that intelligence necessary for DNA tomorrow when we talk about some of the proofs for creation. But chemical evolution isn't taking place. And no one has seen evolution that adds genetic material. What we've seen in this world is nothing more than amino acids being created in a test tube, as the Miller-Urey experiment did. And so as you understand, they try to say in their textbooks that this is really close to creating life. If you get amino acids, you're real close. It takes at least, and this is the bare minimum, 20 amino acids lined up in the proper way to get the simplest of proteins. And it takes at least 220 proteins to create a self-sustaining cell that could replicate itself. And that's coming, that's their numbers, which are a lot lower than some other numbers you'll see by some creation scientists who claim that in life reality, the numbers are closer to 500 proteins. Then it takes a program like DNA to tell the proteins how to line up correctly. And the best science has ever done is come up with some amino acids inside of a test tube about 50 years ago. What we have seen as far as genetic mutations are concerned are the subtraction of genetic material. Back in the 90s, did you know they found a new species of mosquito? They knew it had to be a new species of mosquito because they were living inside the London Tunnel. It's a new species. London Tunnel hasn't always been there. You know the difference between those living inside the London Tunnel and the ones living on the outside of it? The ones on the inside didn't have wings. I said, see, evolution has happened. No, it hasn't. Devolution has happened. Speciation has happened. It didn't add genetic material. It subtracted genetic material. It lost wings. And now these mosquitoes can't get wings back because the material's gone. That's not evolution. And yet they want you to continue to, they want to convince you that this is evolution. But it's not. The only facts that they really have are the fossil record. The fossil record comes with a lot of problems. And if you didn't pick up a sheet, I would encourage you to pick one up on the way. I don't have the time to go into all the answers of of all your radiometric dating and carbon dating. And that sheet doesn't even get, that just scratches the surface of all the information there is on that. But I encourage you to read that to understand some of the problems with the fossil record and the dating systems. The thing about fossils is they don't come with instructions. No instructions whatsoever. They do not tell us that evolution occurred. It's not what it says on there. You don't pick up a fossil and say, this thing evolved from a more primitive primate. It doesn't say that. They pick up a bone and they say, well, I think this came from a more primitive primate.
Or I think this came from a bird that used to be a dinosaur. It's an interpretation of the facts. Evolutionists look at fossils which exist in the present, and they create a story as to where it came from. How many of us know what a caveman looks like? When you start mentioning a caveman, what do you think about? Scraggly hair. It looks like my father. If you get a chance to see my father, it's a good picture of a caveman. Long beard, scraggly hair, and often grumpy looking. I can say that about him because I know he'll laugh. What we think about when we think about cavemen is exactly what Discovery Magazine, National Geographic, NOVA, textbooks have told us to think. No one alive today has ever met someone that lived 5,000 years ago. I'll give you the Bible timeline, not their timeline. No one's ever met someone that lived 5,000 years ago and was drawing on caves. We have no idea whether or not they had a beard, but they say that they did. We have no idea whether or not they had long hair, but they proclaim they did. We have no idea about what their social life was like, what type of language they used. You can't tell those things by looking at a bone and a few artifacts. I read one place that made a lot of sense to me as I was preparing for this. They said they look at the artifacts and they could tell the difference in the shape of the arrowheads or the axes. It says, well, that tells you that this one was more evolved, mentally more evolved. No, it doesn't. Because it could also tell you that this one wasn't as big as a hurry as that one was. Look, the deer's getting away. I got to throw it now. I ain't got time to sit here and wait for it. But that's a possible explanation as to why some are more crude than others. It doesn't have to be hundreds of thousands of years of the evolution of the brain. How many of us know the hunting habits of a Tyrannosaurus Rex? You know, today they try to tell us that they were scavengers. At least that was the latest report that I read. The Tyrannosaurus Rex wasn't a vicious hunter, he was a scavenger. How do they know? Let me ask you this. How do you know whether or not a big cat is a hunter or a scavenger? Well, people have gone out there into Africa with cameras, and they've watched lions. They've gone into Asia, and they've watched tigers. And they see what they do, and they're hunters. You want to know how something gets its food? You'll watch it. No one looks at a set of lion bones and can figure out exactly how it went and got its food. It's bones. They don't talk. They don't come with instructions. They don't come with a history. They're bones. Evolution is not science. It's storytelling. Here's a bone. This is what we think. And sometimes the storytelling is a lot more elaborate than others. Want to see some of the ridiculous storytelling, read up on whale evolution. Some of the bones they found were nothing more than a jawbone. And they have an entire dinosaur in picture to go along with it. They have a jawbone. They have no idea whether it knocked on two legs or one. They have a jawbone. And yet they have told our children over and over again, this is the way it is. But storytelling, it can't be fact. What it makes it is theory, a proposed explanation. And that's what we have here in evolution, a proposed explanation. It is an attempt to explain where all the bones came from. It is an attempt to explain why certain animals have similar traits. And to Darwin, it was a lot more. See, to Darwin, it was also an attempt to explain the reality of death. In Darwin's time, the church taught that God created death and suffering to make the world turn. The sin of Adam during his time had no meaning as real events. The creation story was already doubted based upon the scientific evidence, and I use that term very loosely, of the geological scale. Back in the 1800s, they didn't have any kind of dating system set up. Science hadn't gotten that far. What geologists were doing was they were already doubting the Bible because they had a naturalistic and a materialistic mindset, and they did not want to be held accountable. So they were stating, based upon their philosophy and upon their own ideas, that the world was millions of years ago. That's the first date that was thrown out there. The Comte de Buffon, or buffoon. I think that's where the term buffoon come from. And by the time the early 1800s rolled around, we found things like the gap theory and the day-age theory being taught. I didn't realize that when I was first went into the study. I thought gap theory and day-age theory was something that modern-day Christians were coming up with. But the gap theory was first publicly taught in 1814 by Thomas Chalmers. 1814. 45 years before Darwin wrote The Origin of Species. In 1823, we find the first occasion in which the day-age theory was publicly recorded as being spoken about and being taught. And by the time Darwin began being educated in the school systems, the gap theory and the day-age theory were not only believed to were not only openly accepted, but they were believed to be the only answer to Genesis in chapter 1. The religious world in which Darwin was educated in was far from the religious reality. He was being taught over and over again that God created death. That God used it to create life. And when Darwin looked at death and as God as a creator for it, it didn't make logical sense. How could a good God call death good? That part of his reasoning is accurate. But he didn't hear the truth because so-called Bible scholars were already teaching error about Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis in chapter 2. So Darwin made a new law, the law of natural selection, to explain death. And he ended up creating a new religion in the process. Religion's threefold purpose is to answer why we are here. It answers how we achieve that purpose and explains how that will change our view of the world. To the Christian, when we ask why we are here, we go to passages like Ecclesiastes in chapter 12. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. How do we achieve that purpose? It's right here. You want to know how to fulfill your life in a way that pleases God? It's right here in the Bible, New Testament. Read through it and you can find that answer. And how it explains your view of the world that lets you know that you are held accountable for your actions. That someone is watching and that someone can either reward you or someone can punish you. Evolution has an answer to each of those questions. It explains why we are here by essentially telling us that we are a series of accidents that occurred over a period of billions of years. That's why we're here. An accidental explosion, an accidental spawning of life, an accidental mutation, and another one, and another one. And millions and billions of mutations later, we are where we are today. It makes our purpose whatever we desire. Since we're an accident, do whatever you want. You want to chase after the lust of the eyes, the lust of the heart, and the lust of the desires of the heart, and the lust of the flesh, and that's your choice to do that, and no one can tell you you're wrong for doing that. And it changes our worldview by teaching us that we have no consequences for our actions. And that's the world that we live in today. No consequences for our actions. It's absolutely a religion. We looked at last night how humanism has latched onto this
And in the Humanist Manifesto, they made it quite clear they believed it was a religion, the religion of humanism, which is only natural to take this and go to that point. To the point that we are today in postmodernism, and whatever else leads after that. Because we're nothing but a bunch of animals and accidents. So what should we be on the lookout for? Evolution, as I said, comes in a variety of different forms. So what should we be looking out for? You start hearing things like millions of years, those should be red flags. They should be. I've met Christians that they didn't see that as a red flag. Millions of years. Well, that's how long ago dinosaurs lived. Will God create dinosaurs? Absolutely, on the sixth day. Wait a minute. Time out. How did you come to that? How did you get dinosaurs were created on the sixth day and they lived millions of years ago at the same time? They didn't have an answer for that one. You know what the first words are in almost every single book on dinosaurs? Pick up a dinosaur book and read it to your kids or to your grandkids. It begins something like this. Millions of years ago, dinosaurs walked the face of the earth. According to the Bible, when were dinosaurs created? Well, if they were aquatic or aerial, as they fly around the sky, they were created on day 5, according to Genesis chapter 1 and verses 20 through 23. They walked around upon the earth. They were created on the same day as man. Genesis chapter 1, verses 24 through 31. You can't believe both of them. And that's why it's one of the benchmarks for evolutionary teaching. Incidentally, it was the benchmark when evolution first began being taught. Before evolution was accepted, the church had already accepted millions of years. It's only natural that the rest of it followed. Both doctrines cannot be right. Either dinosaurs lived millions of years before man or they walked the earth with him. Of course, evolution requires you to believe millions of years. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the evidences for creation and a young earth tomorrow. But in the end, as we sung about just before the lesson, it takes faith. It's what it boils down to. Who do you have more faith in? The scientists that proclaim it was millions of years ago, or the word of God that said it happened in 6 days, the fifth and sixth days of creation. Hebrews 11 and verse 3 says, through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are not seen were made of things which do appear. By faith, we just simply have to believe what God has said. As I mentioned earlier, most Christians during Darwin's day accepted the world was millions of years old. They did this because of geological so-called evidences. There were no dates for millions of years. There have been like Charles Lyell, Comte de Buffon, Abraham Werner, all who set forth their own beliefs. They offered zero scientific data. None. They released a picture that had dates on it, what they believed took this long to get to. And because it had doctor whatever it was afterwards, let's go. He must be right. Let us not accept their millions of years. And we need to be careful of them using things interchangeably, the terms evolved and adapted. Those aren't the same thing, although they want you to believe that they are. They want us to confuse microevolution with macroevolution. Microevolution explains the different breeds of dogs. Little by little, the different breeds arose because people bred them to have specific traits and qualities. But they're still dogs. I actually read one Christian paleontologist state this, and I don't know if he was saying it tongue-in-cheek, but I wouldn't put it past it to actually take place. He said, you know, if people were to dig up bones of a St. Bernard and dig up bones of a Chihuahua, 1,000 years from now, after those dogs no longer exist, these evolutionists would say, well, that's two different species. They don't look anything alike. They don't change the fact they're dogs, does it?
What we have happened, as I talked about a little bit ago, was that of speciation, a change within biblical kinds. That's what takes place. Those are facts. But it doesn't mean that something had an addition of genetic material. It means that something got specialized because certain traits were eliminated from their gene pool. The reason why certain dogs, like a Chihuahua, only grow short hair is because the long hair gene inside of it was eliminated through breeding. And they want you to take that as proof of evolution. But macroevolution is drastically different. It's what they use to create the 4.5 billion years of evolution. And they want us to be able to confuse the two because a creature adapted to its surroundings through speciation, then it proves that it evolved into a new creature altogether. This is not the same thing. And you will find them use these terms interchangeably. And what I noticed here as I was preparing this, when I was younger in school, it was macro-microevolution, which they use interchangeably. Today they use adapted and evolved interchangeably. Apparently someone got on the ball and realized that macro and micro are two different things. So they changed the words which they use. But it doesn't change their doctrine based upon these words. Adaptation is microevolution. Evolving is macroevolution. Try not to confuse the two. And they used this one last night. We're just animals. The cry of people against ethical treatment of animals. We're all just animals. Yes, we can have some similar cellular structures. And there are occasions where we have some similar bone structures. But we are not just animals. We have a soul. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7, the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into the nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Well, God created the other animals from the dust, some of the other animals from the dust of the earth, as he will go on to say in Genesis in chapter 2, no other creature on earth was given the breath of life. It is this portion of the creation process that makes us the image of God. We are eternal creatures. We are eternal beings. We are not mere animals. Don't let them try to convince you that you are nothing more than an evolved monkey, a super-evolved mushroom, or single-celled organism. So what can you do to protect yourself, to protect your children, to protect your grandchildren from this teaching? Pay attention to what you're exposed to, number one. Just because it's on TV doesn't mean it's true. And it usually means it's not. When you're dealing with evolution, it always means it's not. Just because there are doctors who say that it's true doesn't make it so. I hope I've showed you some of those things the last couple of lessons. So what can you do? If you're watching a program and they start talking about evolution, there's one of three things that you can do. You can hit the mute button. Talk to your kids immediately about what was said and why it's wrong. You can also hit the pause button if you're watching a movie or you have DVR and just pause live TV. Spend a few moments explaining to your children why it's wrong. And if they continue to teach evolution on the program, you can always turn it off. The off button's there for a reason. You're not forced to watch it. And there's no reason you should force yourself or your children to be exposed to it. Let me put it to you like this. Would you watch a program filled with fornication,
hope not. They're dropping curse words every other sentence. As Christians, we find those things, should find those things appalling and desire to turn the program off because we shouldn't want to have our hearts and our minds and the minds of our children exposed to such things. The same thing holds true with evolution. It will pollute their minds just as much as any other sinful activity can pollute their minds. I would warn you to look out for tour guides. You can walk through a natural history museum and walk past anything that deals with reading. Just look at the dinosaur bones. And then you can turn around and you can look to your kids or your grandkids and you can tell them about the massive creature which God just created. The tour guide, unless you're going to a creation museum, won't tell you those things. They're going to tell you how this evolved over millions and millions of years. And if you feel the necessity to walk with a tour guide, afraid of getting lost in a large museum, or you want to have someone explain certain things to you, don't be afraid to ask questions. Chances are good the tour guide you're walking around with has no idea what the answer is. If they say something along the lines of the T-Rex living 65 million years ago, look at him and say, well, do you know when he was born? Did you meet him 65 million years ago? How do you know those bones are that old? And they start stumbling over something about radiometric dating. And they start stumbling over carbon dating. Oh, carbon dating proves it was 65 million years ago. You can turn around and look at them and say, well, carbon dating was no good after 80,000 years because the carbon is just too small to measure anything beyond that according to your timelines. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Make certain that your children understand the difference between what truth is and what fantasy is. I would encourage you to be involved with your children's education. I would encourage you to do that anyways, but especially because of evolution. You need to be involved with your children's education. And that, because unless your child is homeschooled or private school, they are going to be taught evolution. And that's not to say, I mean, some private schools obviously do teach it, but there are some that don't. You need to be certain that they are receiving spiritual education. It's not enough to tell them evolution is wrong. Explain to them why. Kids ask that all the time anyways. Don't do this. Why? Well, eventually, because I said so doesn't work. Because eventually they're going to say mom and dad don't know everything because they couldn't give me an answer. So when you say evolution is wrong and they say why, show them why. Take them to Genesis in chapter 1. Make them sit down and read it. And say, see, God says so. And if you've been training them up in the Lord all along and making them understand the authority of the scriptures, they're going to look at a passage like Genesis in chapter 1 and say, okay, because God said so, I'll accept it. Of course, that means you have to have an open Bible in your home. I encourage you to make certain that you have that. To make certain that the truth is being taught. Christ said in John 17:17, sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth. The word of God is what's going to make a difference in your life. It's going to change who you are, to take you from a world of sin and make you into what God would have you to be. Our world is crumbling in immorality because they don't want to accept this word. But you don't have to fall into their pit trap. You can see evolution for what it is, a story, another religion that takes just as much faith to believe that this book takes to believe. I don't encourage you, if you have yet to act out upon faith,
to begin today acting upon the right type of faith, and the faith in the right things. I would encourage you to look to God's message and to understand what He commands of you, to understand that He expects you to be better than just an animal, be better than just a person that lives upon your impulses and upon your desires. And that if you are willing to be better than that and live according to His word, He will reward you with a world free from corruption, free from death, free from pain, from fear, by giving you access to an eternal home in heaven. To have that, you must believe that Jesus is the Son of God, that you are a sinful person, and that without His death, without His sacrifice, you have no hope of redemption. You must act upon that faith by repenting of your sins, as Christ said in Luke 13:3, unless you repent, you shall all likewise perish. To confess, as the Ethiopian eunuch did in Acts in chapter 8, and to follow the example of countless men and women in the book of Acts, who are willing to be buried in the watery grave of baptism and then begin living a faithful life. Tonight I ask you, where are you on your road to salvation? If you have yet to receive the forgiveness of your sins through baptism, I encourage you to make that decision tonight. If you have already become a child of God and you've been allowing yourself to chase after whatever your heart desires, and you're living and wanting, and you desire to set your life right with God, by asking for forgiveness for the prayers of the saints, we're here to help. Won't you come now? We'll together stand and sing the song that's been selected.
Jesus is tenderly calling thee home.